So, Kevin, I really liked the way you brought up the concept of informed consent with passengers and how passengers work into this equation. And I kind of want to start there. Since you brought up your own kids and pulling them out of an airplane that had landed in the water, that had ditched, would you still go over the lake with your kids? And if not, what option would you choose in this situation if this was you with your family going out to Oshkosh?
Me with my family, and again, if we're talking me, I'm an instrument rated current proficient pilot. So, am I or am I not in an airplane that's not equipped for instrument flight? If it's equipped for instrument flight, that's easy. I'll take the southern route, and I can pick up an IFR clearance if need be. In that situation, if I wind up inadvertently in IMC with an airplane that's equipped, even if I don't have a clearance at that moment, I can keep control of the airplane. I can request a clearance. I can turn around. I can do things that our scenario pilot doesn't necessarily have on the table as options. So no, with my kids, I'm not flying over the lake. And were I a VFR only pilot flying a VFR only airplane, and I have my kids on board, then I'm still going around the south side of the lake, but I'm going to be spring loaded to divert other places. And I'll try and spin it in some positive way for my kids, as this is some adventure, and try and not say, oh, by the way, we're missing Oshkosh this year because we can't get through the marginal weather, assuming that that's how that plays.
Now, I know everyone else around the table is going over the lake, except for Wally, who I'll come back to in a moment. But Dave, you mentioned when I did the poll around that you would go over the lake, but with a caveat. What is that?
Yeah, my thing is, if the unexpected happens and that engine quits out over the lake, I am not pulling the chute. I am ditching the airplane. You know, winds are light. Sea state is probably pretty smooth. The CTLS has a 35 knot stall speed. I'm going to keep control of the airplane, and I'm gonna ditch it under control rather than take my chances with how's that is that chute going to deploy correctly? You know, how's it in what is the situation in which it comes down to meet the water? I think I've got an excellent chances of a highly survivable ditching if I fly it myself.
Paul.
I got a question for Dave, and then I have a comment. What if it were Cirrus?
If it were a Cirrus, I would probably pull the chute because the chute in the Cirrus, there's a long track record of success with that particular installation. In the CT, there's nowhere like that amount of testing or real world experience.
Okay. I'm kind of 50-50 on using the ballistic parachute if there's an issue. But the larger point I would like to make is that what makes this doable for me, from a risk assessment point of view, is that there are two items, survival items aboard, personal flotation devices and a PLB. And we did a lot of overwater flying to the Caymans and Cuba, and we always on the overwater legs put the PFDs on. Don't just have them lying on the seat because if something happens and you get in an emergency situation, whether you pull the chute or you ditch, getting them on is a bit of a goat rope. And the other aspect of this for maximum survival is to have the PLB on your person because the PLB will be pivotal in quick rescue. I mean, there's plenty of data on the 406 PLBs summoning rescue forces literally within minutes. And around the Great Lakes, the Coast Guard has good assets. They'll hear that 406, they'll track it, and they'll be right on it. And in this case, if you're in the water with PFDs, typically the water's in the low to mid 70s in the Great Lakes during July. So you've got quite a long survival period, probably on the order of 5 or 6 hours before you reach exhaustion. So that's plenty of time to be found by rescue services. If one other thing, or maybe a couple other things I would add to the kit would be a signaling mirror or some kind of flare or smoke or something that you could also signal. And then that's just more stuff in the in the toolkit. I don't think a raft is really necessary because if you're at altitude, your exposure for engine out not being able to reach land is pretty short.
Well, let's go around to Wally then, who I know is going the southern route no matter what. And Wally, what do you say to Paul who says, look, your exposure to an engine failure is this short little window?
I agree. The window's a little longer than you think. This is not a fast airplane, and there's 60 or 70 miles of open water there. Not all of it, part of it you would be able to do a glide to a land, but probably 50 miles at least of unglidable and unlandable opportunity there. It's just the consequences to me. I know it's the chance of that engine quitting is infinitesimally low, but if it does, we're going to be in that 70 to 75 degree water. That's pretty cold. And Paul's probably right about 5 to 6 hours. But sometimes things don't work like PLBs, and sometimes even inflatable devices don't always work. So I'm just not willing to save a few minutes. And, you know, maybe I won't get to Oshkosh. I'm going to go around the south side. This CT is a nice airplane to putter along fairly low. I can slow down if the visibility is bad. I'm not going fast. I'm going by lots of airports. If I don't like what I see, I can land, either try it again tomorrow, get a rent-a-car, drive to Oshkosh. So I just think I don't have to accept the risk. And I'm still going to get to Oshkosh because I'm going to get to Elkhart real easy. And after that, maybe not so easy, but we'll see.
I am curious whether the engine matters to anyone. I know, you know, and maybe I direct this to both Dean and Paul. This is a Rotax engine. And I think it was, Paul, you had said when you did some research in failure rates that it came up surprisingly high, although there's a little bit of a tyranny of small numbers there. But I'm curious about that. And then maybe Dean, I'd love you to chime in as well, because you're going over the lake as well, even though you're the A&P at the table here who, you know, has a real world sense of how reliable these engines are or are not. So either one of you.
Well, for me personally, I was thinking of it as more of a general principle than what engine it is. So to consider the engine, I have rarely ever worked on a Rotax engine, but yes, I have heard about some of the issues with the reliability. So that is a little bit concerning. But it's always a bit of a concern that an engine is going to quit. And part of my thinking was that we have the risk of the engine quitting regardless of any of these scenarios that we choose, any of the choices that we make here. And so if I had the engine quit in any of the three flying choices, I decided I would rather have it in that short stretch over the water rather than over the clouds where I have no idea where I'm going to poke out of the clouds when I come down, or if I get in some really marginal VFR weather and it quits there, my options would be probably very limited as well.
Paul, about engine reliability here, does that really factor in or no?
You know, we've discussed this before, and the more I study it and analyze it sometimes, the less I think I know. You talk to people like Dave's had two or three full up engine outs, and I've talked to people who have five. Those are really not very encouraging. So I don't really worry about it a lot, but it is something that you have to be cognizant of. And in this case, as we discussed, the pilot is he's got survival gear aboard to make the overwater.
Dave.
I haven't done a study like Paul has, but I have flown a lot with all the different GA engines, and I am actually more confident in Rotax than the traditional, you know, Lycoming and Continental. You know, they I've flown them on air cams in which there's two, you know, and I've done some, you know, cross the country trips in those, and I've always been just so positively impressed by how easy they are to operate. I've had them as high as 14.5 going across the desert in New Mexico. And, you know, whether it's the carbureted or the fuel injected versions, the four cylinder Rotaxes are just seem like really excellent, reliable engines. And while I've got the floor here, one thing that comes up often in the across the lake discussion is that, you know, I'm always amused when I hear the, well, just ditch by a boat. You know, I've crossed that lake many times, and very seldom do you see a boat. There's lots by the shoreline. There's some people that fish near the shore, but when you're out in the middle of Lake Michigan, it's rare to see a boat other than you might see a freighter crossing. It's not like the Catalina Channel in Southern California. There's lots of boats there. There's sailboats, power boats, fishing boats, all kinds. And it's like that in that location, ditching by a boat seems like a realistic possibility. In Lake Michigan, it's just not.
You know, I want to build on something Dean brought up, which I think is a great thing to talk about in this scenario. And especially, you know, it's been kind of a worldwide issue, even about evaluating risk, that we have this skewed picture of risk, and the lake is such an obvious risk visually. Like, you see that water and it's undeniable. No matter how confident you are in your engine, I think everybody has a little bit of a feeling going over that lake of being just a little bit uncomfortable. Yet the northern route, the consequences of an engine failure there are potentially disastrous as well, yet you can't see it. It's under the clouds. And we fly, you know, single engine IFR over low weather. People do it all the time. And people who wouldn't fly over a lake even. And then take the southern route. I mean, Wally had a great point that there are a lot of airports to land at, and the ceilings are fairly high, but that could sucker you in because 4 to 5 miles of visibility can deteriorate mighty quickly into, you know, less than VFR visibility. And if you were to try to fly a little bit higher to have some more height in case of an engine failure over terrain and a lot of populated areas, the visibility, the effective visibility, is just going to get worse. So I'm curious what people think about that as well, like how we look at the risk of these three different routes and kind of think about them differently, even though on all of them an engine failure could be catastrophic. Katrina.
Yeah, thank you. That was actually where I wanted to go with the southern route. I think that what we're looking at with the southern route is the difficulty is at the end of the trip. We probably have some get-there-itis. And we're at our most fatigued. And we all know VFR into IMC has often been sometimes a very fatal mistake that people have made. And all of those factors together are part of the reason I really didn't like that southern route. Of course, the answer is to have great personal minimums and a willingness to stay somewhere else. Hopefully, that's what this pilot has. There are a lot of ways out of that situation, but there's no guarantee that that's who this person is.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that at the end of the trip. The stress is at the end of the trip when your decision-making may be at its weakest and your urge to get there just a little bit further before the field closes, before you get stuck somewhere, could be a real problem. Yeah, Wally.
That's why I like all those airports around the south side. They give you lots of options to stop and with readily available hotel space and I'm sure rent-a-cars. Even if the engine quits down there, I'm not going to drown.
Kevin.
Yeah, so as a controller, I've had actually multiple occasions where I was working a pilot who was a VFR-only pilot in a VFR-only airplane. And they got their VFR into IMC. And there's not a single one of them that had any intention of going there. And, you know, it was just could have been after a long day. One of them, I know it was after a long day. For whatever reason, they found themselves in IMC. And the one thing that was really consistent between them was the level of stress and fear on the part of the pilot just absolutely came across the frequency. There was one of them that it was nothing short of amazing that he survived. And there's a couple of others that were less dramatic, but still very much a a stressful, scary situation for those pilots to find themselves in.
Katrina.
Yeah, I don't know how many of you guys have read the JFK Jr. accident, but I think it's a really good example of deteriorating weather. Repeated weather events, repeated updates to the forecast, and how I think it looks to me anyway, and having read it, it's been a while, but the go, no-go decision got made earlier in the day with better weather information. And then as the day went on and things deteriorated, that go, no-go decision never really changed. Not, I think, probably how it would have looked had it been a full reevaluation. And I think that's maybe a takeaway as well. You stop for lunch or dinner or, you know, whatever the appropriate time is before you get yourself into that potentially worse weather than you think it's going to be. You look at the weather again and you say, am I staying overnight here? Or, you know, kind of set yourself a new place to look at the weather all over again as though you were starting from the beginning.
You know, one thing about this that Kevin just brought up about VFR into IMC, I put this to the people who are going over the lake in the non-IFR airplane. This one probably has some kind of attitude display in it, but maybe let's put you in your Cub, Paul, or Dave, you're flying in something that doesn't have any attitude instruments in it. You're going to be heading over the middle of the lake on what could be a hazy day towards the end of the day with the sun in your face. Does that factor into this at all? And if you knew you were crossing the lake without an attitude display into the setting sun, would that change it for you? Or would you still go?
I wouldn't do the lake in the Cub. I would basically scud run around the northern route probably, and I would be have a very low threshold for stopping. I mean, the Cub. I mean, as you know, has exactly zero going for it. I mean, it really is just an engine and some wings and a little bit of gas. It's really not practical to do this.
You know, I've crossed the lake in a Super Cub, and it had, you know, a turn coordinator, and so you know, it had, that's an, I guess you could certainly consider that an attitude instrument, but you know, in this situation, I don't think it would give me a lot of pause, because you've got really good VFR weather behind you and a really good VFR forecast in front of you, and you've got about 30 minutes of exposure over the middle of the lake. And if it gets bad, you've got a really great 180-degree turn option. And just to quickly address your question about risk assessment, I think it's highly regional. I remember being in a Cessna 180 with a Montana pilot, and we're flying over this really rugged and remote wilderness. And, you know, he's asking me how I could possibly fly over water, you know, just, and, you know, isn't that really scary to fly over water? And I was thinking, wow, look at what we're flying over right now. I would take water over this any day of the week. You know, also pilots in the LA basin, you know, they flying in the clouds, that must be really crazy. You know, why would you fly single engine IMC? But it's like, look around you, you know, and you live in one of the most unlandable places on the planet, you know. So I'm always struck by the regional nature of the risk assessments.
Right, and that could be very particular even to the conditions. I am curious, is there anyone who the northern route, so VFR on top over some pretty remote terrain, would be just a no-go? I mean, if there were thunderstorms blocking the other two routes, but that could get you to Oshkosh. Is there anyone who wouldn't go, or are all of these really viable depending on what your risk benefits are? Not a single hand. So everyone would say, oh, no, Dave would not go. So you wouldn't go over on top.
No, well, I'm saying that. No, I mean, I love VFR on top, and smooth air over a stratus layer is just my favorite conditions to fly in. But this is summertime, you know, with that cloud layer below you may be, you know, it may be heating up and rising up converting itself into thunderstorms pretty fast. So it doesn't give me a lot of comfort.
Fair enough. Kevin.
I don't have any problem flying VFR over the top for the same reasons that Dave was just talking about, where it's often great flying weather when you're doing that. But I would say that it depends on how long you're going to be there and what's underneath. In this case, we've got a whole bunch of Canada that's a very remote area, and we're not set up for customs. And in that way, I feel like in this scenario, you're sort of painted into a corner. But in general, I don't have a problem VFR over the top.
You know, I found it interesting here how I expected here more controversy. I expected to have more of a split, but most people are pretty comfortable going straight over the lake. And I have to admit, I've done it many times myself, because that's a risk benefit that I'm comfortable with. But like Paul, every time I've done it, it's been the, life preservers on with the automatic inflator removed, so I wouldn't go off from the water automatically inside the airplane if it filled, and we had the PLB with us. But I could absolutely understand other people taking the southern route, or even someone taking that northern route. To me, listening to what people say, it's a matter of running the consequences of what each one of those is going to be. What equipment you need to have if you're going straight over the lake, and what the state of the water might be, or the sun in your eyes without a horizon. If you're going to be taking the northern route, thinking about what it's going to be like if you need to get, if you're going to be stuck out there for a while, or have your passports on board, right? And if it's the southern route, it's, are you really prepared and have you committed to just going to the next airport instead of all the way to Oshkosh? And then maybe the next airport after that. So you're always deciding to continue rather than deciding to land short of the end destination. That seems to be what this is really about in terms of making a smart decision, is figuring out which you're most comfortable with and then being prepared for how that's actually going to play out.